This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The story of white supremacy in the United States is littered with the names of famous white men like George Wallace or David Duke. They wielded power over influential institutions and asserted their beliefs in dramatic and visible ways. But my guest today argues that focusing on just their actions obscures important lessons about why things are the way they are today. To understand why racial violence and injustice still prevails, historian Elizabeth Gillespie McRae argues, we also have to look at the actions of white women. In her new book, Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy, she details how white women throughout history have propelled white supremacist ideals through their roles in schools, homes, hospitals, the press, and political discourse. Elizabeth Gillespie McRae is a professor of history at Western Carolina University and joins me now. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your book really dismantled some of the biggest myths about white supremacy, the idea that all these white men were sort of in charge and made it happen. Tell us more.
Well, I think, and this has probably been exacerbated recently, is that when we think of white supremacy, we think of the most important purveyors of the men that you mentioned. They're either male and violent, like, and working class and rural, like the KKK, or they're male elected officials, like George Wallace, Ross Barnett, right? The list goes on, that control legislation and government institutions, and that white supremacy sort of trickles down from them and up from violence, I think. And right, this has been promoted even recently when we think about the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville and the images we see from them and the focus on the alt-right or the far right. And not that they're not important, but those folks are sort of easy, right? We have pictures of George Wallace. They're easy to pick out, right? They're standing in the schoolhouse door. They're marching and have swastikas and flags. But I think the system of racial segregation and of white supremacist politics is so entrenched and broad-based, and it goes beyond those people, right? And instead, it's the purveyors of it are also the people that we go to church with and go to school with.
And you talked about this, the fact that the pictures show these guys. But, you know, I noticed this and sort of should have made a better mental note of this, because whenever I look at those pictures of rallies and white people spitting on black people in demonstrations, I did notice the number of women who were screaming and outraged and spitting as well. And it just never occurred to me that maybe they were playing a bigger role in showing up at the rally. And this is what you discovered.
Right. And it's the everyday, right? It's the women that are school teachers and civic club members and PTA members and, journalists that have weekly columns, that they do important work at this grassroots local level. And in, instead of thinking about racial segregation and white supremacist policies trickling down, I think we are better able to dismantle it if we think about it bubbling up from this local and grassroots level, where we know that women do lots of work.
Well, give us some examples now, because I think you started your study in the 1920s, so maybe you should tell us a bit about what's going on, but also give us some of the particulars to show us how this works.
Okay. So I think, as you said, I look at sort of social welfare and public welfare policy. So in the 1920s, the progressive era state was expanding, right, to provide more services. And women had an entry into that state. And in Virginia, for example, they passed in 1924 the Racial Integrity Act, which was essentially the one-drop rule. And it was going to eliminate people with interracial and mixed race backgrounds and force them into either a census category of black or white. But in order to do that, they had to rely on local people to police the populations. And so what you had were midwives who had to turn in the racial identity of the babies they delivered, and, or social work students who were supposed to go do research and catalog the sort of poor behaviors of people that came from this mixed race background. And they were, I'm told, to do this and trained by their professors who were sociologists who had trained with race scientists in New York. And so the progressive era state and this law relied on the work of local women, right? Teachers calling and saying, I think this child comes from a background that's not all white. Registrars changing the racial identity of folks who wanted to get married, midwives, school teachers. And so that's just one way that people that we would associate with progressive era, the expansion of women's professional roles, also built the state in a sort of way that reified white supremacist policy.
Yeah, so already you're sort of tearing up a bunch of myths, but also building a case for how powerful ground-up grassroots activity is, and of course the role of women in it, in both progressive movements and, as we see, regressive movements like white supremacy. And you profile a number of characters in the book who throughout history have worked to reinforce white supremacy. You tell the story of Nell Battle Lewis. Tell us more about her.
So she's a North Carolinian from Raleigh. And if you look at Nell Battle Lewis in the 1920s and 30s, she seems to be an iconoclast. She supports textile workers. She supports the Gastonia strike. She works to end capital punishment. She criticizes the justice system. But after World War II, she moves increasingly, her politics seem to move increasingly in support of white supremacist politics. She is one of the architects in North Carolina of massive resistance and was happy, I think, in 1956, right, on the eve. She dies in 1956, but she felt like North Carolina had proved at that point that they were going to resist racial equality and the quest for integration. But if we look at her work and the stories that she told, and I argue that she's a Jim Crow storyteller, she always believed in white supremacist politics. She just worked to make sure she thought the best way to ensure that segregation, racial segregation would last would be to really meet the promise of equal in separate but equal. So there needed to be better social services for Black North Carolinians. There needed to be equal pay in education. And the length of the school terms needed to be equitable. So she's, if you had to pick a white supremacist in the 20s, right? I guess she's a good one to pick, right? But she never wavered, and she believed people like her, enlightened, educated, white folks, should be in charge of racial change.
Right. And so, and this gets to this kind of tepid form of white supremacy that has the ironclad effect of locking racial injustice in place, but with this veneer of equality and some form of justice, plays itself out to some degree in North Carolina with the election of Luther Hodges, and you write about him,
sure,
and the rise of citizen councils and the way in which women played a role in those. So talk more about that.
So across the South, right, citizens councils are initially male dominated, but then they have women auxiliaries, and the women that join are particularly important in working in public education to continue to teach the lessons of racial segregation. For example, in Mississippi, the Citizens Council will sponsor an essay contest in 1960 that over 5,000 white Mississippi high school students participate in about why social separation of the races is sort of the best system. And this was orchestrated by women that worked with the Citizens Councils. And the reward for the winning essay contest was $500, which in that day would have paid for 4 years of college tuition at a state school. So, right, the investment in this by women who are working in the schools and have support of the PTAs and of school teachers is pretty extensive. Right, in 1960, it's the sit-ins. Like, the system is crumbling, it appears, yet they are still working to shore up public education and make sure it teaches the lessons of Jim Crow citizenship.
And this is not only in the South, but this, we can see this very much in the North, particularly when busing is the issue, right?
Right, right. So, and I think that's where you can see women take to the streets in pretty dramatic ways. is a clear tie between women's investment in schools and their sort of control over that. And then Southern segregationist women predict that when Northern and Western schools are integrated, that those white women will behave just the way that Southerners did. And in many ways, they did. In Pontiac, Michigan, in Louisville, in Boston, it is white women that try to uphold segregation in their public schools.
Tell us the story of Alice Moore in West Virginia.
Oh, so.
Sweet Alice Moore.
Sweet
you have that
Alice
in quotes,
Moore,
but apparently that's
right.
What they called her, right?
Who is a transplant from Mississippi, I think, right?
Yeah.
And so Alice Moore moves into a place that has a rich history of labor politics, right, and of labor organizing. And she works to make sure in the 1970s that multicultural education doesn't make it into the counties of West Virginia. And that if you're going to teach about African Americans, Booker T. Washington is who you can teach about, right?
Not Eldridge Cleaver.
No, not Eldridge Cleaver.
He's anti-American, but Booker T. Washington, the assimilationist.
Right.
Well, let's have more of that.
Right. And so what happens is this is a moment, if we look at Sweet Alice Moore and her work in the school board and that she invites the far right in, but also that she shifts a population that had been sort of pro-union, pro-labor into a cultural politics that highlight their white supremacist impulses and beliefs.
All within a role that is understood in conservative circles for women. So while they're playing, in a sense, a leading role, albeit
right.
from the bottom up, which
right.
is another important part of this, they're maintaining what conservatives would consider their role. I think maybe there's a pretty good example of this with Hugh Bell from North Carolina in the way they were selling segregation, right?
Yes. So Mrs. Hugh Bell, right,
right.
who after the Brown decision, she orchestrates resistance in the eastern part of the state, in Pender County and New Hanover County. And her a defense of her campaign against integration is that she's a white mother, right? And that as a mother, this is her responsibility. So she can be politically active, but not be politically threatening.
And how does this play out, too? We think about, you talked about how this does go north, that when questions like school integration, and again, This is the province of the woman. We can talk about education, right,
mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm,
conservative
mm-hmm.
circles. And then there's Louise Day Hicks. We're talking about busing in Boston now.
Right.
And it was a powerful and contentious fight, in many ways, led by women.
Yes. I think Boston is led by women. Pontiac, Michigan is led by women. And they look to the feminist movement and say, look, busing, this is a women's issue. And when feminists do not support their campaign against busing, right, that pushes them further into the circles of the right. They would maintain, right, that they're not like Southern segregationists. So they get the label of anti-bussers rather than segregationists. And I think we should label based on the work that they do. And if so, then they are segregationist as well.
And talk about there, because this is fascinating, because what we're saying is that women played a part in American political life all the way through, that
right.
we have not recognized this because,
right.
because we've been looking in all the wrong places. Now we're seeing it. How effective were they? I mean, how is this movement, and not only in the immediate causes that they were fighting for, but in generating these, in propelling what we would now call the culture wars?
Right. And policy wars, I think,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it depends. If you freeze it in time, it looks like in the 60s they're losing, and even in the 70s that they're losing. But if we fast forward, right, to resegregation that's happening, to the defunding of public education, to the rise of a language of school choice that often serves elite interest, right?
Right, rather, it's not segregation. It's now school choice. The same
right,
way
right,
busing,
right.
Anti-busing,
I think yeah. we should be cautious. Like, we should investigate the language, the outcome of the language that is used. And so I think if you take a long look and my work ends in 74, but I think I ask you to take a long look, that we see that in some ways, right, the white supremacist politics that we have seen bubble up lately are, again, not episodic, are part of these, I mean, we should investigate, but are part of long trend that women's political mobilization in the 20th century and in the 21st century also, in part, was a mobilization for white supremacist politics.
So if there's a long civil rights movement, there's also a long
massive resistance
movement. I'm talking with Elizabeth Gillespie McRae, the author of Mothers of Massive Resistance, today on The State of Things. So how does that play out? You know, you wrote several op-eds inspired by your research, and one that you wrote for The Washington Post was called White Women Overwhelmingly Supported Roy Moore. We Shouldn't Be Surprised. Tell me more about that argument.
So one of the reasons I think we don't know this history is because, and I'm guilty of this as well. So when I got called from the Washington Post to do that op-ed, they're like, why would women support Roy Moore? And I guess I was like, oh, I don't know, but why would anyone support? Like, why is it a particular right. women's job, right, to defeat Roy Moore? And I think what that speaks to is, in spite of mounds of historical evidence that some groups of women, some not all white women, but some groups of women and white women in particular have perpetuated a really politics of segregation, politics of white supremacy, a conservative politics that some people, right, particularly like from a feminist position, see as an antithesis of women's interest, right, mm-hmm. of what a woman's interest is, that we see that women have long participated in this. And so we are surprised. Right. But we shouldn't be surprised, right? But I think we have essentialized women's political consciousness in a way that we imagine, I think, that women have a particular set of political beliefs that arises from their biology, right?
Right.
And that is really entrenched in American society.
And so what this does, and I think what your research does, is, again, blow that apart. There's not a women's vote. There's not a women's vote because there's not a woman's interest. Again, as you say, that would essentialize women, and that's exactly what a good women's movement would fight against.
Right.
And it also, I think, points to some of the critique of the women's movement, which is that it's fractured, it's falling apart, there's all this contention. But it's precisely that, and remember, resilient and effective, mm-hmm. so it is effective, mm-hmm. And it's held itself together. And so what you're really saying is that in all of this, well, maybe you're not saying it. You can disabuse me of this if you don't agree. But, I mean, the idea that this kind of resilience and appetite for dissent is, in a way, what makes the women's movement resilient and perhaps effective, whatever the goal.
Right. But they have to fight against an expectation that they represent all women, right, of all political ilks. And no one expects that of a man's movement, right? I mean, no one expects that. And so I think some of the critique of the women's movement emerges from this belief that they need to serve, right, all women, no matter, right, and that all women have this sort of same political consciousness. And so I think it also serves for maybe unfair critiques of the women's movement.
Elizabeth Gillespie McRae is a professor of history at Western Carolina University, authored the book Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth is going to be talking about her work at Chapel Hill Public Library tonight at 7 o'clock. The event is hosted by the Center for the Study of the American South, and you can get details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk with the third and final candidate for state Supreme Court. Chris Anglin joins us. Stay with us.